The Round Pretty Eyes of the Hebrides, a duet poem. Mary Ann McLeod woke up in the Oval Office of the White House, where her son Donald shouted on the phone with stylized power. They never spoke when she came here, but she would wait, watch, looking as she had before her marriage, still shone for him with the round pretty eyes of the Hebrides, hair, kelt curly and lips mischief sweet, a bride for a hopeful German, but a neat domestic servant, one eye on the dust and the other on the dance. She'd met Fred at a dance, and he had wanted at once to buy New York for her, a strange lack of confidence in his powers of persuasion. Donald turned off the phone, quieted by her presence as usual, but as usual did not address her, in terror that if he did she might just go away. He could monologue to himself, however, and sometimes so did she. He said, "It's not that I've got something about mothers as such. I was happy to call out the bushes on that matriarch thing, the way they used Barbara to make them seem wholesome. What was wholesome about the Iraq War, I ask you?" She wasn't meant to answer, did not want to, but he knew she understood, with her deep Ireland Highland frugality, Appalachian in its intensity, the profligacy of war, that rich man's hound sport. He said, "I had the courage to call them out on Iraq to their faces, and so behind me the Appalachians took notice, kept their children closer, not to have them killed or turned to clowns, court-martialed for every ordered, acted torture. Rich families have matriarchs, but we poor men have mothers." She wondered if she'd been a matriarch, perhaps not. She said, "My son Donald was always a mystery. Indeed, when he was 13, we enrolled him in the New York Military Academy when we discovered secret visits to Manhattan all the time. It was strange, since he seemed so Presbyterian. That concentration of fixing a sin and not confessing it could have been direct from my own father. Indeed, I was brought up speaking Gaelic, a practical language quite unsuited to guilt or religious ostentation." He said, "A serious day's intact so far, thanks to me, while Hillary would have invaded it using no-fly zones, when ISIS never even had an air force. You'd think even apprentice press sometimes could put two and two together." She was looking again at his recent gold decorations in the Oval Office. He had replaced the Obama rug, rimmed with quotes from presidents, with one golden, like a small sea at dusk, and the mountainous drapes glistened as if asleep after a storm. She said, "It is good you put back Mr. Churchill's bust, at the same time kept the one of Martin Luther King, who was, after all, an unusual Lutheran like your father." He bent closer to her in the golden ocean, gently, so that she remained, with her eyes fine circles taking in the room. That old Hebridean mix of awe and pity did not leave him, striding his new rug with awkward, almost flounces, his hand in his lion-lank hair. She gave him calm. She thought aloud, "There is so much that is important about money. The rich have such a gift for seeming poor. What I wore when I married your father was the brightest fashion, coats extravagantly collared in protection. He was fearful of infection from all others, being German. He housed the poor in the city, but we had to defend his exclusion of blacks to the Department of Justice. It wasn't quite like that, though. He gave the poor what they wanted, to be exclusive, and that means the power to exclude." On a table, King's head looked back, it seemed, with equal pity, pride. Donald could remember articles on some song by Woody Guthrie, just discovered, that upbraided his father for such things. They said Guthrie would have equally opposed him, but, in truth, he wasn't sure. Guthrie was a man sick in body, but in soul healthily half New York ballet, half Appalachian jig. He might therefore have understood Donald's need to oppose, to be definedly defeated, a need to square the deep state about the Russians, to square the army on Afghanistan, so the dust storms from dead deserts didn't take him down, and with him his Jewish daughter's frail country. There was a picture of her on the resolute desk, furniture he would never replace as it steadied his grip when signing. Mary Ann was looking at that picture of Ivanka. There was a sweet timidity in the perfect lips and eyes, their deer-like stance fixed a second too long on the observer, but the mouth still had a Hebridean faith and expectation. Flamboyance in golds was all around, like wildest autumn. Mary Ann felt Hebridean caution. Her son, in his phased defeat, ragged-edged, paced, braced like a brittle leaf, walked away from her with gold beneath his feet.